Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. On today's programme, we take a special look at the crisis-hit countries in southern Europe. Italy faces a power vacuum after inconclusive elections. Spain's politicians and royals are mired in corruption scandals. Can Greece ever emerge from its crippling debt crisis?
This is going to be still a very tough year for Greece. You get the sense that there's this extremely delicate situation, extremely sort of fragile bubble at the moment, and one little pinprick and the whole thing could explode once again.
And taking a stand in Portugal through protest songs. Those stories and more coming up in the programme. Italy is in the midst of a power vacuum after shocking election results, which have left the country's political landscape deeply fractured. The balance of power is now held by a newcomer to the political scene, the Five Star Movement, led by comedian and blogger Beppe Grillo. He garnered the most votes of any single party, but is refusing to lend his weight to a larger coalition. As Megan Williams reports, the days ahead could be tumultuous for Italy, with politicians trying to make deals in order to get a workable majority.
That's comedian Beppe Grillo at a final campaign rally crying out to Italian politicians to surrender. You're surrounded by the Italian people. Just days later, the usual political suspects on the right and the left came close to having to do just that. Grillo's five-star protest movement, fueled by frenetic blogging and rowdy rallies, took everyone but themselves by surprise by winning about a quarter of the vote. Berlusconi and his Northern League backers started low in the polls at 15%, but they gained votes through promises of a rebate in property taxes, among other things. Political economist Giuseppe Ragusa says it was the Partito Democratico, known as the PD, who were the biggest losers. They won more seats, but no governable majority.
I think something that is not well understood is that the PD lost the election more than Berlusconi won it.
Ragusa says the Partito Democratico made two crucial mistakes. First, by choosing the less appealing older former communist Pierluigi Bersani over the young Mayor Renzi of Florence as their leader in the primaries. Second, by playing it safe in the campaign.
They didn't take sides. I mean, the campaigning was basically, we are ahead, and so we're going to be very careful not to say anything because we're going to win by default.
Without enough votes to control parliament, the Partito Democratico leader Bersani is already reaching out to Grillo's five-star members. Grillo responded with a typical tirade against Bersani, calling him a dead man talking who should quit. He ruled out giving the center-left a crucial confidence vote in parliament, allowing them to lead, and said the five-star deputies and senators would vote on laws on a case-by-case basis. This could cause even more confusion, says Giuseppe Ragusa, because it's not clear what exactly unifies the five-star members.
Even Grillo doesn't know the member of parliaments newly elected, nor the member of parliaments know each other. So there are going to be 150 people showing up the first day, and they don't know each other. So
indeed, at a victory party for the Five Star Movement, its jubilant members seemed clear about one thing only, their passion for change.
We are against the system. We want to change certain things. We believe that the economy is not helping the people. We believe in a greener economy, greener energy. We believe in many things which are, I think, mandatory for everyone, anywhere in the world.
We have no political experience, that's right, but we have a passion. Passion, and we are very, very determined.
Political commentator Lucia Annunziata agrees the five-star movement is a great unknown, but she says it could still be an improvement over the deeply out-of-touch politicians in parliament until now.
up to now, you know, the people they have elected have been always very decent people. The middle class, well-educated, but on their way down, you know, feeling that their destiny is ruined in a way. So in the sense, middle class and middle age with no big hope for the future, and which has somehow built a resentment against the system which has not protected him or her.
That resentment for now is a political wild card. Already, divisions in the Grillo movement have emerged, with members expressing disappointment in his unwillingness to work with the center-left. Grillo members had hoped the Partito Democratico would implement some of the reforms that they'd been pushing for. And as Italy's urgent economic problems and high unemployment only worsen, political economist Giuseppe Ragusa says the country could be moving closer to another crisis.
The real problem are going to come in the next 2 weeks when we are not going to be able to have a government, and probably at the same time we are going to have to balance the budget, given our very slim economic growth may be necessary. At that point, we're going to be in big trouble.
Meanwhile, Europe waits with bated breath. The financial markets have already been plunging at the fears that Europe's third largest economy might not be able to get its house in order anytime soon, and that the fabled austerity measures, started under the interim Prime Minister Mario Monti, won't be continued. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Well, as Italy struggles to deal with its political turmoil, Spain is facing problems of its own. The country is no stranger to corruption scandals, but in recent weeks a particularly explosive case implicating senior politicians in the ruling party has sparked a full-blown political crisis. With the royal family also fending off its own damaging allegations, Spain is facing a deeply unstable period. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
I'm standing outside the national headquarters of the Popular Party, the Conservative Party that governs Spain. In the last few weeks, this building has been at the centre of the biggest corruption scandal the country has seen for years, after El País newspaper published details of what it claims was an illegal fund run by the Popular Party with which it made under-the-table payments to senior party figures, including Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. According to the allegations, the fund was financed by illegal donations from construction firms, and it only stopped operating in 2008. When Rajoy had been party leader for several years. Rajoy and others at the top of the party have denied the allegations. But without a doubt, the man who was in charge of the Popular Party's finances for years, Luis Bárcenas, is a huge problem for the Prime Minister and the government. Bárcenas, here talking to the press outside his home in Madrid, allegedly controlled the illegal party fund, and he is being investigated for fraud. The Bárcenas scandal, as it has become known, is just the latest and biggest in a long string of political corruption cases. Even before this affair, over 300 politicians were being investigated for alleged wrongdoing. Spain is in a deep economic crisis, but now when people take to the streets to protest against austerity, they also vent their anger at a political class they believe is corrupt. It could be a long time before this latest case reaches the courts, if it even gets that far. But many think that the government will pay a high price for it.
Rajoy has no escape in the end, so he will have to face probably the responsibility for what has been going on in his party.
Political scientist Fernando Vallespín believes the economic crisis has destroyed Spaniards' traditional tolerance of corruption.
I think it has a worse effect now than it would have had just 10 or even 5 years ago. When you see that some politicians have been giving jobs to friends or relatives, then you have 25% of a population which is unemployed, then you're enraged.
But the spate of recent corruption cases isn't confined only to politicians. In recent months, Spain's royal family has become embroiled in a scandal, with the king's son-in-law, Iñaki Urdangarín, suspected of having siphoned off millions of euros of public money when he headed a charity. That case is a major reason why the royal family has come under increasing scrutiny in recent months. The leader of the Catalan socialists, Pere Navarro, has even taken the unusual step for a mainstream politician
of calling for the abdication of King Juan Carlos.
King Juan Carlos has played a magnificent role in the transition to democracy and its defense, and in the building of the Spain we know today. With all due respect to his role, our proposal is that what we need now is a change when it comes to the monarchy.
Not so long ago, such a call for the king's abdication would have been deeply shocking. But Spain now seems to be entering a new era in which some of its most traditional institutions, such as the political class, the royal family and the financial system, are being deeply questioned. Fernando Vallespín.
We have realized that this country was more corrupt than we thought. We've passed from a Mediterranean moral consciousness, so to say, regarding public ethics to a Scandinavian one. And in that sense, now we are judging with Scandinavian eyes, let's say with Swedish eyes, what we did when we were Spanish.
As Spain battles to keep its economy afloat, it now has a new fight on its hands, a political crisis sparked by corruption that is undermining Spaniards' faith in their leaders. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Madrid.
And I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. We move now to Greece, a country that's still in the grip of a debt crisis so big that there's talk that it could be forced out of the eurozone. And corruption has made a major contribution to that crisis. This week, a court in the northern Greek city of Thessaloniki convicted three of the city's former top officials for embezzling more than 17 million euros of public money. The three, including the former mayor, were all given life sentences. Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent in Athens, Mark Lowen, and asked him whether this was a sign that Greece was finally cracking down on corruption.
It's a very, very strong sentence indeed, and I think very much intended to be a sign that nobody is above the law here. And yet there is a widespread perception, I would say, among Greeks that a culture of impunity, political impunity, certainly for the political class here, has long existed, that the political class has been untouchable, even though it's been absolutely riddled with corruption and clientelism and nepotism for so many years. There's a feeling that the political class in this country have lined their pockets for the last four decades since the end of dictatorship, while ordinary Greeks have struggled on. And so one conviction, albeit one high-level conviction of this ex-mayor, albeit a significant one of that, I think is not necessarily going to change people's viewpoints. That said, there are some other signs that the culture is beginning to change, culture of accountability is beginning to emerge. Last year, a former defence minister was arrested on allegations of money laundering, and at the moment, a former finance minister is being probed for allegedly tampering with an official list of possible tax evaders.
You mentioned tax evasion there. I mean, they reckon that at least half of Greeks are still not paying what they should in terms of taxes. What does that mean for that country?
It means that Greece is losing a lot of revenue, which it needs desperately at the moment. It's estimated that tax evasion might be costing the Greek economy upwards of 10 billion euros a year, at least that. And this is money that it simply can't afford not to have. So Greece is under immense pressure to increase its tax revenue, tax collection. It is notoriously weak here. Tax evasion has long been a sort of national sport in Greece. But the newish coalition government is under pressure, not least from its international lenders, from the Troika of the European Union, the European Central Bank and the IMF, to really get serious on this issue. But still there are signs that it is not doing so. There was a leaked report yesterday from the Troika that said that they are disappointed that the clamping down on tax evasion has not been as serious as they had expected yet. Even though there are cases now of people being brought brought before courts for tax evasion. It is simply not quick enough. It is not efficient enough, that the tackling of this issue. So this is something that Greece has been Greece's Achilles heel for a long time. It is something they must get serious about if they are to convince the international creditors that Greece is on the path to recovery, and if they are to get that much needed revenue that they must get at the moment.
And do you think Greece is on the path to recovery? I mean, the news seems to have been a bit quieter in the last few months about Greece. Is it simply that the media have got bored and gone on to other stories? Or can you sense on the streets of Athens that things are changing for the better?
Well, when you speak to government officials, they do say that. And when you speak to top-level businessmen and international investors, they feel that Greece has calmed down, is calming down, is on the path to recovery, albeit a very, very slow path. And certainly, you get the sense that the country's credibility abroad has recovered somewhat. We've had the French president here in the last couple of weeks. We had the German chancellor here last autumn. These were people who were cajoling and berating Greece from the sidelines before. This was the black sheep of Europe just a few months ago, and now it is being lauded for its reform efforts. But the big question is that feeling of confidence, is that feeling of optimism filtering through to the average person on the street? And on the whole, I would have to say no. You know, when you speak to ordinary Greeks, they don't care about things like primary budget surpluses, which is what the government is going on, which is a sort of reduction in the deficit figures. What they care about is that the situation for ordinary Greeks remains dire, that unemployment is still soaring. It is now 27%, and among young Greeks, it's 62%, and it is expected to rise even further. They care about the fact that taxes are still enormous, that their salaries have been cut, and that pensions have been cut too. So this is going to be still a very tough year for Greece. And even though it has calmed down, certainly on the international news agenda, you get the sense that there's this extremely delicate situation, extremely sort of fragile bubble at the moment, and one little pinprick and the whole thing could explode once again.
That was Mark Lowen speaking to me there from Athens. Now to another country that's been forced to seek an international bailout, and it's a familiar story. Portugal is bracing itself for a new wave of social unrest as people take to the streets to protest against tax hikes, cuts, and soaring unemployment. But while in Greece and elsewhere many resort to violence, the Portuguese are finding their hope and strength in music. Old protest songs have made a comeback, and there's talk of a new movement sweeping the mainstream pop music industry as well. Cynthia Taylor reports from Lisbon.
Grândola Vila Morena, by the late Portuguese protest song artist Zeca Afonso, was a criticism of the former Portuguese regime under Salazar. The song provided a backdrop to the 1974 military coup that put an end to 40 years of dictatorship in the country. Since then, it's become a symbol of freedom for Portugal, and it's now being used to protest against the current government.
Conclusões do último Conselho Europeu quanto ao quadro financeiro multianual.
Nós. A speech by Prime Minister Pedro Passos Coelho was interrupted in February by a group of citizens who started singing this song. It was just one of several such incidents that have targeted members of the cabinet in the past month.
I know it's a very difficult time for our country. I'm talking about starvation, hunger, things that I never expect to see in my country in the 21st century.
Nuno Duarte, a.k.a. Gel, is a comedian and musician who is part of the movement making the Portuguese protest song popular again. He and his brother have formed a humorous musical duo called Homens da Luta, Men of Struggle. They impersonate protest song artists from the time of the dictatorship. They've been accepted by the mainstream too. Their rebellious act won the 2011 Portuguese Song Contest. But Nuno Duarte thinks that this new wave of protest is different from those of the dictatorship.
The old intervention artists here in Portugal, they were more engaged. This ideological thing was more alive. Now it's dead, you know. Now you notice that artists engage more in an issue. For instance, the unemployment.
One of the new wave artists talking about unemployment and lack of professional perspectives is folk pop group Diolinda. In 2011, they received a standing ovation when they premiered their song Parva Que Sou, What a Fool I Am. Their words struck a chord with the audience. What a stupid world where in order to become a slave, you must take a degree.
It was a moment that lived beyond music. It was a moment of connection between human beings.
Ana Bacalhau is the group's lead singer. She thinks the country has been numb for too long.
People were comfortable in their lives. They had perks, they had, you know, a job. And they thought that political intervention was not required. And so I think we just let politicians work without our surveillance for too long. And that happened with musicians also.
But now, things have changed. Not a month goes by without a demonstration in Portugal. Unemployment is the third highest in the EU. Those who can't find jobs abroad flee the country. Fernando Tordo is another dictatorship-era protest musician. His song Bullfight talks about beasts, fools, and describes a complete circus. It was a hidden dig at the regime. Singing a song like that, he could have been sent to prison, but he decided to risk it anyway and submitted a song for the 1973 National Song Contest.
At that time, we were for everything, you know. We couldn't care less. The situation was a desperate one. And so we decided we were crazy. We were crazy.
Against all odds, Bullfight won the competition. What saddens Fernando Tordo, though, is the fact that 40 years later, the song is being requested at his concerts again. In a way, he feels that not much has changed.
At that time, it was exactly like that. Now it's exactly like that, but in some terms, it's worse. Because we live in democracy. Because we have political parties. Because we have politicians. Because we have more education.
There may be more democracy in Portugal today, but oppressed by economic hardships, the people feel they have little to cling to, except maybe to the age-old words of protest. As it says in Grândola Vila Morena, land of fraternity, it's the people who rule. For DW, I'm Cynthia Taylor in Lisbon. Dentro de ti, ó cidade. Dentro de ti, ó cidade. O povo é quem mais ordena.
Haunting music there from Portugal. Well, we always like to hear what you make of the items in our program. Our email address is europe@dw.de, or you can write to us at Inside Europe, the European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. Thank you. This is Inside Europe and I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. Over the next half hour, the Latvians fighting to clear their Soviet-era health records. The communist past looms large in the Czech Republic. The German comedian who's cracked the British comedy circuit. And some strange sounds coming out of Berlin.
The easiest way is to take their sounds and mess with them, you know, as you can easily do with technology. But the more challenging thing is to go out and play live with all kinds of creatures and see what happens.
Those stories and more coming up on the program. It's over 20 years since Latvia declared its independence after the breakup of the Soviet Union. But one group of Latvians is still living with the mark of that past. They're those who were wrongly locked away in psychiatric institutions after being diagnosed as mentally ill because of their anti-Soviet views and actions. And decades on, that diagnosis still stands. Now, a Latvian politician wants to change the law so that they can clear their mental health record. But, as Gerdertz Gerdes reports from Riga, the victims don't want to have to undergo further humiliating tests.
In 1989, when the Iron Curtain was beginning to fall apart, one of the first documentaries was made about the horrors of the Soviet regime. The film was called The Dissident, and it was about a 53-year-old Latvian lawyer who was locked up for years in psychiatric hospitals.
Jums raksta latvietis Pēteris Lazda.
Pēteris Lazda is now 77 and he's still schizophrenic, that is, on paper. He was diagnosed with this mental illness back in 1978, after the KGB arrested him. Lazda had written leaflets saying Latvia wanted to leave the Soviet Union and calling on Moscow to loosen its grip on the Republic. After his arrest, a show trial took place. Pēteris Lazda says the verdict was merciless.
The court decided to send me to a hospital for an indefinite compulsory treatment. It means confinement for life. They were hoping that I would die there, that somebody would kill me there.
Lazda was first sent to a psychoneurological hospital in Riga. Then he was kept in prison, and eventually he was sent to psychiatric clinics in Leningrad and Volgograd.
I had a very, very tough time in Leningrad. I met an Estonian who was also locked up. He'd already spent 17 years there, and he told me that I would never leave the place. So you can imagine how that affected me.
Lazda was forced to take various antipsychotic medicines, like haloperidol and amazine. He says they sometimes made him really delirious, but that was just one part of the ordeal.
The maintenance staff at the psychiatric hospital were criminals who were put away after committing crimes like robberies and murders. They actually killed some patients. When that happened, a prosecutor would arrive, make a statement, leave, and the case would soon be closed. The victim's remains would be buried on the hospital's grounds.
Lazda managed to survive the torture and somehow managed to be discharged in 1982 after 4 years in detention. He was able to return home to his wife and daughter, but he couldn't get a proper job because he was still officially diagnosed as being mentally ill, and that restricted his work options. Pēteris Lazda is one of up to 50 Latvians who were victims of the political abuse of psychiatry under communism, and their records still haven't been cleared. Andrejs Judins is a member of parliament and he wants this injustice to finally end.
If documents state that somebody has been diagnosed with a mental illness because that person didn't want to serve in the Soviet military or was critical of the communist regime, then there are grounds to rehabilitate that individual. And that diagnosis and treatment have to be declared false.
Judins adds that people like Pēteris Lazda should have their diagnosis revoked simply by assessing the historic documents. The victims, he says, shouldn't be subjected to any new traumatizing experience like a psychological screening. But psychiatrists don't agree with him. Birūta Kupča is a professor of psychiatry at Riga's neurological hospital.
Yet, jurists izskat tos dokumentus.
If lawyers examine the documents and establish that people have been persecuted, then they can rule that oppression took place. But they can't make or cancel a diagnosis of mental illness. Only a certified psychiatrist has the right to do that, and nobody else.
Professor Kupcho is also sceptical that such cases even exist.
I have worked in psychiatry for the past 55 years, since the age of 17. Perhaps I'm a rare exception, but I have never come across such patients.
But historians say that political dissidents were indeed locked away in Riga's psychiatric hospital. Ritvars Jansons from the Museum of Occupation of Latvia said on national radio that it's important to clear the records of these victims.
If we don't openly acknowledge that such people exist in Latvia, then we'll never be able to come to terms with our past. These people should be entitled to their legal rights. They have to be granted a status of having been politically oppressed, so that they're entitled, for instance, to receive medical aid from the state.
Politicians have pledged to correct this historic injustice without delay. But ironically, Pēters Lazde is not at all enthusiastic about the opportunity of being rehabilitated. In fact, quite the opposite. Lazde says that it's deeply insulting that politicians have taken so long to remember people like him, and he says he doesn't want to prove his sanity to psychiatrists who he doesn't even trust. Jadars Džēlzis, DW, Riga.
To another country where the communist past still looms large. This week marked the 65th anniversary of the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia, which was followed by 4 decades of totalitarian rule. The regime, of course, collapsed in November 1989, but the present-day Communist Party is still strong and enjoying renewed political power in a number of regional assemblies in the Czech Republic. The anniversary, therefore, was a time not just of reflection, but also looking to the future, and, as Rob Cameron reports from Prague, emotions at some events were running high.
February 25th, 1948, Klement Gottwald, leader of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, announces to a crowd of workers on the Old Town Square that President Beneš had accepted the Communist Party's demand for a communist-dominated government under threat of a general strike and intense pressure from Moscow. What followed was a steady slide into dictatorship, as Gottwald, backed by Stalin, cemented his position with show trials, mass arrests and executions. Hundreds of thousands of people fled the country. 65 years later, the Old Town Square was the scene of a different type of demonstration, as members of an anti-communist initiative organized a small rally to mark the occasion. They were there to protest against the continuing presence of modern-day communists in positions of authority, mostly at a local level. Petr Marek, the initiative's spokesman, had this to say to Czech television.
It's a huge disgrace that the Communist Party is still so strong in Czech society, regardless of what they did in the past. It's a party that's against democracy, and we're going to continue in our campaign of informing people so they realize this. The communists are so strong because the current population is so incredibly passive.
Several hundred people later marched to the headquarters of the leftist Social Democrats, who've formed coalitions with the modern-day Communist Party in a number of regional self-governing authorities. Their opponents accuse them of slowly letting the communists return to power through the back door. Across town in Prague's Olšany Cemetery, elderly communist supporters mingled with young left-wing activists at Gottwald's grave to pay their respects to the man they say ushered in a period of fairness and progress in Czech society, regardless of the excesses of the 1950s. Lukáš Koláčik is the chairman of the Union of Young Communists.
The days of February 1948 will be remembered in the history of the Czech and Slovak people as the most democratic change in their history. It was a socialist revolution. At the head of this struggle stood Comrade Kliment Gottwald, chairman of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, without doubt the most important person in our modern history.
There were minor scuffles at the graveside as anti-communist activists planted a sign saying, "Welcome to the grave of a mass murderer," much to the annoyance of an elderly party supporter. The ceremony was attended by perhaps 100 people, some carrying red flags bearing images of Marx and Lenin, though a far cry from the stirring mass gatherings of the past. But while there are grumblings at a resurgent Communist Party gaining a scattering of posts in the regional administrations, there have certainly not been mass protests of the sort that shook the country in 1989. That could change if the Social Democrats win the next election and form a minority government with communist support. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
A short story about success, or perceived success. It was less than 60 days ago that the Irish government laid out benchmarks for what they believed would make a successful EU presidency. Ireland holds the presidency of the Council of the European Union until this July, and Irish leaders have an ambitious agenda. Back in January, our correspondent in Dublin, John Sepulvedo, reported it would be almost impossible to accomplish everything on their to-do list. But now he's here to tell us that the Irish are very close to doing just that.
At the opening of the Irish presidency, Taoiseach Enda Kenny made the next 6 months almost sound really easy.
Our presidency motto is short and simple, consisting of just three words: stability, growth, and jobs.
But behind that simple motto is a sprawling agenda that includes things like getting leaders to agree on a EU budget, keeping agricultural subsidies in place, smoothing relations between France and the United Kingdom, and jump-starting talks with the United States about a free trade agreement. Meanwhile, Kenny almost made it sound like Ireland's leadership would save the European Union.
The Irish presidency will be one of a recovery country driving a recovery agenda for Europe. The task for Ireland in this new phase is the same as the task for Europe: to create recovery that lasts and enables job creation for all our people.
Oh, and on top of all this, Ireland wanted a new bank debt deal to help ease the country's own internal budget cuts. So, a quick recap: an EU budget, agricultural subsidies, the smoothing of UK-Franco relations, and free trade talks with the US. Sound crazy? Well, it might, but the news speaks for itself.
European leaders in Brussels have agreed a new and reduced budget for the next 7 years. It's been a long time coming. Talks went on all last night and throughout today. But the final figure represents the first...
This 3% reduction from the current budget marks the first time that EU spending has ever gone down. This will see cuts in aid to poorer countries and in spending on cross-border infrastructure projects. Meanwhile, France has managed to safeguard its prized farming subsidies.
US President Barack Obama has called for talks on a far-reaching free trade deal with the European Union.
Tonight I'm announcing that we will launch talks on a comprehensive transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the European Union, because trade that is fair and free across the Atlantic supports millions of good-paying American jobs.
Ireland has struck a long-awaited deal to ease the burden of the debts it took on to rescue its banking system. Prime Minister Enda Kenny won European Central Bank approval. Kenny told lawmakers...
I believe that today's agreement is a significant milestone. It closes a sad and tragic chapter in our economic and political history.
There's still a long way to go. The European Parliament has to approve the EU budget, and France and England are still not best friends forever. Also, the US and the EU are nowhere near finalizing a free trade agreement, and even the Irish bank deal isn't complete yet. But Gavin Riley says clear Irish leadership has really helped the EU break stalemates and produce better policies. Riley is a staff writer for the journal.ie, and he says you can really see the impact of the Irish presidency, particularly on the EU budget.
I would imagine that although Ireland may not be 100% responsible, certainly I would think it inconceivable that it would have gotten this far without at least having significant Irish impact involved in it.
That's because, Riley says, Ireland was able to act as a bridge between France's goals for more agricultural subsidies and England's push for less spending.
So Ireland would have been quite a nice middle ground for those countries, and particularly with Ireland's stance as being a general, pretty reliable arbiter.
Among other accomplishments, Riley says that Ireland has helped lead the investigation into the EU horsemeat scandal, although that scandal did start in Ireland, and that it was under the Irish presidency that the EU patent court was established. Now, that reform has been 40 years in the making. Riley believes that these victories are helping to turn around Ireland's image.
By saying that you are a big country and that you have a lot to contribute, as well as reminding the rest of Europe that you're not a basket case, you're also reminding your own public that you have a lot to contribute as well, and that ultimately Europe is a good forum where smaller countries can be heard with equal weight and be given equal time and weight to the bigger countries.
Now, if you're rolling your eyes listening to this, because it sounds like cheerleading for the Irish government, just stop. Nobody is suggesting that Irish leaders are infallible or that Ireland is doing this all on its own. But in a week when 25% of Italians were so sick of their government they voted for a new party led by a former comedian, or at a time when fighting between U.S. political parties over spending cuts threatens to sink the entire country into a recession, it seems a bit novel what the Irish leadership has done. They outlined what they wanted to do, they're buckling down, and they're accomplishing it. At least for now. For DW, I'm John Sepulvedo in Dublin.
And I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. I think it's fair to say that the Brits think that the Germans have no sense of humour. But one German comedian has managed to make it big in the UK comedy circuit. He's called Henning Wehn, and he regularly appears on British radio and TV. He describes himself as Germany's comedy ambassador to the UK.
Now, let me get one thing straight. We Germans, we like a laugh, just like you Brits, we really do. The only difference is we Germans, we laugh once the work is done, whilst you laugh instead of doing any meaningful work, and it is the main cultural difference. And must admit, I've never ever done stand-up back home, never ever. Reason being, I'm not good enough to cut it in Germany. If you want to have success as a stand-up in Britain, all you have to do, loads of swearing. And in Germany, we don't swear at all. Reason being, things work.
Well, Henning Wehn had never done stand-up in Germany. That was until last month, when he came to Bonn to perform a show called What's So Funny About the Germans? I went along to watch and interviewed him as he came off stage. I started by asking how he'd managed to conquer the market as the funny German in the UK.
Well, it was great dedication and efficiency. So, no, there was no master plan at all. Just stumbled into a new act night years and years ago without any idea what to expect. It was a sign outside a pub saying tonight stand-up comedy, and I was just intrigued, went in and had a look, really enjoyed what I saw, and then treated a headline on the night to a beer, and in return he wrote me down a few phone numbers of my comedy gigs, and next morning I picked up the phone and arranged my first few comedy gigs. So there is no big secret to it.
So 10 years on, the act has developed, but do you feel like you're still resorting to the old stereotypes of the Germans, the Nazis, the Holocaust, all the football as well, all the things that are familiar to the Brits?
Well, you have to pick the audience up where they are. So, and you have to acknowledge the reference points the audience has. And obviously those stereotypes are all quite prevalent still in everyday life in Britain, but I wouldn't really say, I would say I use those stereotypes, if at all I use them as a springboard to get onto something that's more interesting or more meaty.
And at heart, do you think the British and German sense of humour is actually very similar? You must have quite a good sense, especially performing here tonight, of what works and what doesn't.
Well, the humour isn't actually that different. What is different is the social importance of humour. Like in the UK, being a comedy club everywhere, every job description includes good sense of humour is required, so you wouldn't find the equivalent of that in Germany. Then the whole concept of self-deprecation, that it's okay to laugh or failure. So that's socially acceptable. It doesn't matter how badly you mess up in your line of work. As long as you can tell the tale of your underachievement in an entertaining fashion, you'll be all right. And that just wouldn't work in Germany at all. It would make matters twice as bad.
I've also noticed, as a Brit living in Germany, that there's a lot of slapstick here, which I'm not sure goes down so well in Britain. I don't know what you feel about that.
Slapstick? Well, people shouldn't be too stuck up about it because, I mean, just look, Mr. Bean or... Yeah, like, if you look at Benny Hill or Rowan Atkinson, or something like Little Britain, that is... Or Naomi Rander, what she does, she mainly falls over. So, and she's now the hot thing, mainly she's lying on the floor. Then you have got Mrs. Brown's Boys, that's essentially... I mean, that is slapstick. So to say slapstick doesn't exist in Britain, I think that's not true at all.
You spent the evening here analysing Britishness and British humour in front of a German audience. What have you drawn from this evening? Have you kind of learned something, do you think?
This was a very challenging evening, as in I really didn't know what was expected. I didn't know if they wanted me to do stand-up. I didn't know what was expected. And I know there is something there. There is a grain of something good, but not sure how I could harness that. I really don't know.
Fair enough, you're straight off the stage. So, and I'll just ask you lastly, Do you think you're more funny in German or in English?
That's a very good question. As a stage act, I'm funnier in English because I do that every night of the week. If it comes to improvisation, then I think I'm funnier in German because it comes to me more naturally. So... if it's only like sometimes if you want to try and improvise in English, there is then a word that comes a thousandth of a second too late. I'm slower in English, but by so little that. But the speed really is of the essence, so you have to be really quick if you want to be funny off the cuff. And that I find a lot easier in German still.
Well, that was German comedian Henning Wehn speaking to me there after performing in Bonn. We move on now to a different kind of performance in a city which promotes experimentation and encourages artists to push the boundaries of creativity. Berlin is, needless to say, home to some very creative musicians. But what happens if you remove the human factor? Is it possible to find music that hasn't been created by man? Well, the team at Berlin's House of World Cultures certainly seem to think so. Last weekend, they hosted the Unmenschliche Musik, or Inhuman Music Festival, dedicated to music created by animals, machines, or by accident. And who better to find out more about some of the very bizarre sounds on offer than our own very bizarre reporter, Gavin Blackburn. He sent this report.
It started with my interest in nature and doing something for the natural world, caring about it, and then thinking how to connect it to my life as a musician.
David Rothenberg specializes in making music in the animal kingdom.
I always was impressed how music could help people communicate with others from different cultures. Something happens, so why not extend it beyond the human species? You can musically communicate with birds and whales and even with bugs. And so I've been doing more and more of this and learning a lot in the process.
This is David's symphony of insects and woodwind recorded in the hills of Glenwood, Ohio for his album Bugs. He's just one of the artists appearing at the Unmenschliche Musik Festival, removing the human element from music. Defying the old showbiz saying never work with children or animals, David thinks working with animals presents a wealth of new creative possibilities.
The easiest way is to take their sounds and mess with them, you know, as you can easily do with technology. But the more challenging thing is to go out and play live with all kinds of creatures and see what happens. The most challenging is to play with humpback whales, because they're singing underwater, these long, complicated sounds. But sometimes you can get them to interact with you. I actually think animals are making all kinds of music. There's more music in nature than there is language.
The four-day event at the Haus der Kulturen der Welt didn't just feature the relatively serene sounds of insects and whales. In one of the conference rooms away from the hustle and bustle of the main hall, electronic musician Andrew Peckler talked about his installation, Prepaid Piano, inspired primarily by a pun on Prepared Piano, a piece by John Cage.
So the Prepaid Piano consists of five mobile telephones that are placed inside of a grand piano directly on the strings, and their numbers are given out to the audience. The audience then calls these telephones. Their vibration vibrate the strings of the piano directly. These sounds are then amplified via microphone and sent onto an electronic apparatus that loops and modulates the resulting sound. So the sound keeps looping and repeating until the next incoming signal. Personally, it comes back to the Cagean idea that the whole world is a musical instrument. It's just a matter of framing and reference. The vibration of the mobile telephone can be music when it's declared such.
One of the ideas behind the mini-festival is to make people rethink the concept of humanness and to hear music in less traditional places. So what did some of the visitors make of the experience?
I think some were very successful, actually like all of them, but in very different media, and I think they succeeded in like translating all of these themes.
I think about the functionality behind the music and how the background of music, how music and techniques interact with each other, and the kind of interplay between humans and techniques and so on. So it makes me think about the background of music.
Co-curator of the festival, Detlef Diedrichsen, doesn't think you have to go to a concert hall to hear music. With an open mind, you can hear it everywhere. He's also clear about what he hoped visitors to the event might learn.
I hope that they come out thinking more intensively about mankind, about human vanity. Now, for example, with the work of Professor Cope, a lot of people feel insulted that he has a machine composed in the style of Johann Sebastian Bach, who is, you know, somehow a holy figure in the world of music, and he may not be treated like this. This is something that makes people aggressive, and they try to prevent this. These points are interesting. Why is it so important that music is distinctively human, and what will we lose if tomorrow a spaceship lands and out come aliens with beautiful music? What will we do? Kill ourselves? Why? So I don't think this program will give answers, but it may produce thinking and questioning and re-questioning and change of views, and because of that, enrich your understanding of the world.
With an Evil Music and Stupid Music series planned for later in the year, there are many more unusual sounds set to be heard in the Haus der Kulturen der Welt throughout 2013, and even more opportunities to think about music in a slightly different way. Gavin Blackburn, DW Berlin.
Well, those bizarre sounds from Berlin bring us to the end of this week's show. And it's also the last time I'm presenting this programme, as I'm heading off to Pastures New in London. So from me, Joanna Impey, a big thank you to my colleagues Helen Sini and Gabriel Borud. Thanks also to the sound engineers. This week, Jürgen Kuhn has been on the other side of the glass. And thanks to you for listening. You can tune in again, as usual, at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.